In Colombia, an unprecedented announcement from the president came this week.
Muy buenas tardes a todos ustedes.
Temporary protected status for nearly 1 million Venezuelan migrants who fled their regime.
El significado es enorme.
It could be a game changer. I'm Marco Werman. Also today, English lessons go viral on TikTok in Russia and get mistaken for a political statement.
I left my passport at the hotel.
And a sound 17,000 years old resurrected. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for being with us today. Impeachment proceedings continue in Washington. In the House, the prosecution will make its case against former President Donald Trump for incitement of insurrection. Security is still at heightened levels outside the Capitol building. National Guard members are there and fencing with razor wire still posted out front. But how long will this continue, and how did the Capitol breach change the state of U.S. national security? For this, we're joined now by James Stavridis. He's a retired Navy admiral and former NATO Supreme Allied Commander. First of all, Admiral, just a practical question. How long will Washington look like the way it does today, with heavy police security, National Guard, and limited access for the public?
Marco, it's going to be determined by the intelligence generated by the FBI as they look at whether or not there is a realistic threat of some kind of repetition of the terrible events we saw on the 6th of January. Realistically, my assessment would be that it will be downsized significantly following the conclusion of this impeachment trial. To put a number on it, I'd say it'll start to look normal, if you will, in about 2 weeks.
Zooming out to the whole country, what are some other national security implications that followed the Capitol breach? What has changed throughout the country, and how wide do you see the threat right now?
Let's start with the U.S. Department of Defense. New Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, former general, good friend of mine, roughly a contemporary, has asked for a 60-day stand down, which means that over the next 60 days, every unit in the military will take a day and look at the challenges posed by extremism, white supremacy. Has that penetrated the ranks of the Department of Defense? I don't think so to a level of national concern, but certainly it's worth looking at that. Looking at municipal law enforcement, I think you're going to see heightened attention paid to extremism and white supremacy. And finally, the FBI will have turned a great deal of its terrorism apparatus to looking at these domestic terror threats. Those are big changes, and they have all come since the 6th of January.
So that stand down, it's kind of incredible. A pause in normal operations for commanders to remind their ranks of their mission and to talk about extremism in the military. Have you ever seen anything like this in your time in the armed forces?
No. And it is a sad state of affairs that the Secretary of Defense is forced to do this, but he clearly has challenges. A recent poll by the Military Times, which is kind of the best sourced polling data on active duty military, indicated that one-third of active duty military had at least seen instances of racism, radical activity in the ranks, white supremacy. I hasten to say that doesn't mean a third of the military follows those kind of beliefs. I would guess it's a tiny percentage. But even a small number can have outsized influence. And let's face it, every member of the military is a volunteer who has sworn to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. You really want that number to be zero. So this is a significant challenge for the military, and I'm glad Secretary Austin is addressing it.
The military stand down, is it a symbolic move, or do you believe that this will actually work and addressing it for, I don't know, a day will make a difference?
I think it is both symbolic in the sense, Marco, that it demonstrates that the leadership at the very highest levels is looking and taking this seriously. But I think there's a pragmatic component to it as well. Each of these units will spend a day refocusing, if you will, on that oath to the Constitution, on stamping out inherent, incipient, or institutional acts of racism, it will raise consciousness. And will it solve all the problems in one day? Absolutely not. But it at least gets us down the path, both symbolically and pragmatically.
Before we go on, Admiral, I'm just curious to know from you how much the various U.S. military operations around the world in recent decades have radicalized parts of the armed forces. When you think about that possibility, what occurs to you?
When I look at what is happening today, I think the military is really just a reflection of our society at large in the United States. People come into the military from all walks of life, from every state in the Union. Some of them come in with very fundamental beliefs that are difficult to change in the military. And as our society has become more polarized, Marco, you're going to see more of that within the military. When you add to that the stress that you mentioned of long deployments in these forever wars, being away from their families, with each other in close quarters in Iraq and Afghanistan. These can be petri dishes for creating the kind of challenges that we see in society, and they're reflected in the military as well.
Petri dishes in what way?
When people are cooped up together, they're conducting combat operations, they don't have that day-to-day break off, go home, be with your spouse, be with your children, get away from the office, if you will, there becomes tension and pressure that is heightened, and it can lead to people having the influence on others simply because they have much more access to them over time. The amount of time, if you will, in the office, in this case, the office, has been for many of these soldiers and sailors and airmen and Marines, the office has been close-knit combat operations forward.
I'm speaking with retired Navy Admiral and former NATO Supreme Allied Commander James Stavridis about the aftermath of the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. So that insurrection, Admiral, that is being debated right now by Democrats and Republicans, regardless of the outcome of the impeachment trial, is this a post-9/11 situation where this is the new normal?
It is not. I do not believe. I think that there will be higher levels of security around the Capitol, but I think that will be in the range of 200 or 300 additional troops, if you will. Not even troops. These are going to be Capitol police officers. The Capitol police force, as it currently exists, is between 2,000 and 3,000 sworn officers. They're backed up by the D.C. police, and they are backed up by the D.C. National Guard. So I don't think we're going to add a lot of individual large numbers of troops. I think you're going to see some of that fencing coming down. But again, this will be conditions-based, which means it'll depend on the intelligence that we are gathering, we, in this case, being the FBI, about the threat of domestic terror to the Capitol.
Given the new reality we're facing, this new normal, do you think a commission along the lines of a 9/11 commission to determine not just what happened precisely on January 6th, but how it happened, should that be formed? Should that be created?
It absolutely should be. The example you just gave, 9/11, we did a commission. We did a commission after Pearl Harbor. And I think this is an event, a single point event that shocked the nation. And we deserve to understand what went into it, what we did wrong. And I think we will find a number of tactical things that went wrong in terms of defending that Capitol building. And we need to make sure it never happens again.
Symbolically, what effect does all this have on the U.S. population? And also on the flip side, how does this affect the way the U.S. is seen from abroad?
Let's take from abroad first. After all, the name of the show is the world. The reputation of the United States has been diminished in the eyes of the world by these events. Now, can we come back from that? Yes, we can. And the United States has certainly been through other instances of this, but we have work to do if we're going to bring that back. And I think inside the United States, Marco, I am hopeful that this will serve as at least something of a wake-up call to our population, that our politics of division, which are pulling us further and further apart, cannot be allowed to continue. We have work to do at home and abroad.
Retired Navy Admiral and former NATO Supreme Allied Commander James Stavridis speaking with us about U.S. national security in the aftermath of the Capitol breach last month. Thank you very much, Admiral.
Thanks, Marco.
The government of Colombia announced this week that it will grant temporary protected status to nearly 1 million migrants from neighboring Venezuela. This is by far the most ambitious plan across the region to welcome Venezuelans fleeing the authoritarian rule of Nicolas Maduro. Here's the world's Latin America correspondent, Jorge Valencia, with more.
This was a major diplomatic announcement, so it happened in a formal ceremony.
Muy buenas tardes a todos ustedes.
President Iván Duque of Colombia addressed a room full of ambassadors in his country's presidential palace.
Ya la crisis migratoria venezolana supera.
He says that by the Colombian government's estimate, the number of people fleeing Venezuela has exceeded the number who have fled the war in Syria.
Son más de 6 millones de hermanos y hermanas venezolanas que han salido de su país.
More than 6 million Venezuelans have left their country, Duque says, and about a third of them are in Colombia, a country of about 50 million people.
Nosotros hacemos público. La decisión de nuestro país.
That's why, Duque says, the Colombian government will allow undocumented Venezuelans living in Colombia to receive legal status and a government-issued ID good for 10 years. Many Venezuelans already have legal status in Colombia, but about 1 million do not. President Duque was joined by Filippo Grandi, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees.
Yo creo veramente que aquí hoy estamos en presencia.
Grandi calls the Colombian government's measure historic. And indeed, across Latin America, unilaterally granting migratory relief to people fleeing the political, economic, and humanitarian crisis of Venezuela is without precedent. So says Maria Clara Roballo of the Venezuela Observatory at the Rosario University in Bogotá.
Esta medida no tiene antecedente en Colombia y ni siquiera en la región. O sea,
Roballo says this is the most ambitious humanitarian plan for the Venezuelan diaspora anywhere. Many Venezuelans have also fled to Ecuador, Peru, Chile, and other countries.
El significado es enorme, realmente como una relación gana-gana.
Roballo says this is a win-win. She says the Colombian government will get a better picture of who's living in the country and will be able to request international aid. Not to mention that registering migrants will make it easier for them to get coronavirus vaccines. People with legal status will have fewer difficulties getting work, health care, and schooling. But many Colombians are sure to be unhappy. Last month, a national poll found more than 2 out of 3 Colombians have an unfavorable opinion of migrants from Venezuela.
Pues hay que preparar a la sociedad en todos sus niveles.
Roballo says we have to prepare society at all levels to truly accept the presence of migrants. And while this plan won't take effect for months, many are celebrating. Juan Viloria is a Venezuelan research scientist living in the Colombian city of Barranquilla.
Fue sorpresa.
This is a surprise, Veloria says. For him, this is good news for Venezuelans who've been fleeing their country for years. He says it's an acknowledgement that millions have been forced to leave.
6 millones de personas al menos han huido del país. Y huir es muy diferente a migrar.
Veloria repeats the number. At least 6 million people have fled, and he says that's telling of the situation inside their country. One question now is whether other countries will follow Colombia's example. And this might be an indication. The ambassadors who attended President Duque's ceremony were from the U.S., Canada, and a handful of European countries. And not a single ambassador from Ecuador, Peru, or any other South American country showed up. For the world, I'm Jorge Valencia.
A story about a 17,000-year-old conch shell caught our ears. We'll explain just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The powerful deluge came without warning, killing at least 30 people. On Sunday in the northern Indian state of Uttarakhand, a glacier crashed down a mountain slope and through 2 dams, sending an enormous surge of water and debris downstream into towns and villages. Arun Shrestha has been following this closely. He's with the International Center for Integrated Mountain Development and joins us from Kathmandu, Nepal. Arun, theories have been evolving about what caused the collapse of this glacier and the avalanche of water and debris that followed. What is the current thinking about what triggered this deluge?
The most important thing is to, you know, find if there are still some more survivors and try to rescue them. So that is the most important thing.
Right. Understanding
the mechanism, you know, what exactly happened is very important to prepare for the next time. I have to speak with a little bit of caution here that at the moment, I cannot exactly say what has happened there. There are several hypotheses. Now the indications are that a mountain slope, which was earlier covered with ice, now also with ice, but less amount of ice, not an active glacier to say, a huge mass out of it fell down quite dramatically and caused this event.
Even if the exact cause of what happened is not yet clear, we do know that glacial melt can cause flooding, and the glaciers in this region are melting quickly because of climate change. How big of a liability are these unstable glaciers for human safety, just generally?
Agreeing to you, Marco, that in some way the event is related to the fragile landscape and probably the rapidly changing environment, which could be related to climate as well, right? And the retreating process, shrinking process of glaciers. It is very important to understand what's happening there, how the glaciers are changing, and what kind of hazards they are creating, for example, formation of glacial lakes. But then again, it is very important to understand the risk factors also, what is there in the downstream in the impact area.
Explain what you mean, what could be downstream in the impact area, like towns and villages, for example.
Right. So it is not only the biophysical environment which is changing in those areas. The socioeconomic environment is also very dramatically changing. For example, more and more settlements are being, you know, developed. There are more, you know, houses. And of course, hydro dams, hydropower-related dams and other hydropower-related infrastructures are being developed in a rapid manner.
With the sheer fragility of the glaciers upstream, many scientists, as you know, have been warning that large hydroelectric projects might further destabilize the environment there and pose unanticipated risks. Do you see that as a factor in this case?
In general, if you have a big hydro dam, particularly if it is in this kind of very fragile environment, where possibilities of outburst floods are there, you know, something hitting the dam and breaking it, that could release a huge amount of water, and that would mean much bigger event than glacial lake outburst flood. Yes, so these are possibilities. But what I would like to say is that, yes, before planning such large infrastructure in this kind of environment, very careful planning has to be done. And the whole landscape has to be looked at from this angle. What are the hazards? You know, what are the possible impacts of those hazards? You know, and then if there are, you know, hazards which cannot be managed, I think some alternatives should be drawn.
Arun Shrestha is a regional program manager at the International Center for Integrated Mountain Development, speaking with us from Kathmandu. Arun, thank you for talking with us about the possible causes of this disaster in the Himalayas. Really appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Marco. Thank you.
And for a bit of good news from the natural world, take a listen to this. Those sounds were produced by the shell of a conch, and not just any old conch shell. This one is 17,000 years old. It was found in a cave in southwest France in 1931, but only recently did scientists figure out it was used to make music, revealing it as the earliest known conch horn. Gilles Tosello from the Research and Studies Center for Prehistoric Art at MSHS Toulouse was on the team that made the discovery. Hi, Gilles.
Hi.
So just for fun, I pulled out my tuner, and it tells me these notes are B, C-sharp, and C. Hard to know whether the chromatic scale was on the minds of people 17,000 years ago, but the concept of making music that far back, is it surprising or not?
No, it is not surprising. Of course, music already existed since 20,000 years, because the most ancient wind instrument we have dated up to 35 or 40,000 years.
But to be clear, the notes, the tones we just heard, those came from this particular shell, 17,000 years old, correct?
You're right. They were produced by the original shell, played by a professional musician. He tried different notes and produced that sound. It was a sort of artistic choice.
So what do you think the sounds made by blowing through a conch shell were used for 17,000 years ago? Was it entertainment or something more practical?
I would say something more spiritual, more maybe religious, because the shell was discovered during excavation at the entrance of a cave with cave art inside. That means paintings, engravings of animals, geometric signs, humans.
For decades, apparently, the conch was thought to be a drinking vessel. What made you change your mind that it was for making sounds or noise or music?
Because one of the co-author of the study noticed that the tip of the shell is a huge shell, more than 30 centimeters long, almost a kilo weight. And the hardest part of the shell is broken, and it's almost impossible to be broken naturally. Then we looked closer and we noticed, in fact, that there were some hits all around the edge. Hmm. And then inside, a small hole has been drilled from the broken edge.
So the sounds we heard a moment ago, you say that came from a professional musician. Have you and the other researchers, though, had a chance to kind of play a few notes on this conch?
I tried, but it's pretty hard. It's also hurting the lips because the broken edge is very rough. If you try to blow inside, then your lips hurt. It's also, you need to be trained. It's like playing in a trumpet.
Why the skepticism, though? Because aren't there a lot of connections over time to making sounds with the conch? Like Steve Touré, the trombonist, is actually better known for his performance on the conch and his research into how more recent societies used it.
Exactly. That's what we are planning to do now, to maybe a complete replica of this original shell, because what is missing is probably the mouthpiece to protect the lips of the musician. Otherwise, it's almost impossible to blow inside.
It is pretty remarkable. What was it like when you made this discovery?
I was completely, you know, surprised, and then I had a big emotion, especially when the musician played these three notes, because I just realized that nobody was able to play that instrument since 17,000 years. It's like being the first to hear that since that time.
Gilles Tosello, one of the scientists who made the discovery that a 17,000-year-old conch shell was actually a musical instrument. Gilles, thank you very much for telling us about this.
Thank you, too. Bye-bye.
You're listening to The World. Hello, Marco here. This past year, listeners continued to show their unwavering support for The World. Together, we raised over $100,000, thanks to the following people that helped us reach our goal. Sujata Alake, Lily Kale, Nat Smith, Marjorie Zimmerman, Bridget Kauston, Sean Fitzgerald, Mariko Ishikawa, Sarah Nelson, Diana Cattarello, and Elisa Lenson. Thank you all for helping us bring human-centered journalism to listeners all around the world. A Greek-speaking community in Turkey has deep connections to the past, but only a few thousand members.
We need to refuse the diagnosis that's been given us, of saying that we're the last, we're done.
That writer is urging her people to rewrite the narrative. We join her on a stroll through Istanbul, coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In Haiti, there is a fierce debate underway. Opposition activists and lawmakers are demanding that Haitian President Jovenel Moïse step down. They say his 5-year term ended on Sunday. Moïse is refusing. He says an interim government occupied the office during the first year of his term, so according to him, he has another year to go. The standoff has sparked angry protests in several major Haitian cities, anti-government demonstrators and security forces facing off in streets filled with burning tires, makeshift barricades, and tear gas. Now Haiti's government has thrown prominent opposition members in jail and charged some with plotting a coup. Widlor Merancourt is editor of the Haitian news outlet Ayibo Post and joins us from Port-au-Prince. It sounds like a very difficult time in Haiti right now. How do Haitians see the standoff, Widlow? Do they agree on who their head of state is at the moment?
Okay, it's hard to know. It's hard to know what Haitian thinks because of COVID, but also because of the insecurity climate. So the police officers are being used by the government to crack down on any sign of protest. So in this situation, if 2-3 people gathered together, police officers used tear gas to disperse them. And on top of this, you have a constitutional crisis where the president's term is set by the constitution. It's 5 years. And according to the constitution, the president's term is supposed to end this year, 7th on February 2021. But the president refused to step down.
We heard a moment ago how the anger is spilling into the streets, protests turning ugly, becoming street battles between police and security forces. Have you seen any of these confrontations up close?
Every time people go into the street, they try to protest against the government, or they try to raise their voice about what is going on in the country. The government use police officers to crack down on these protests. I've seen personally police officers beating journalists. I talked to journalists beaten by police officers while they were covering a mass protest against the administration. And along with that, you have another situation where the government is using gangs to crack down on protests. You have a civil institution like the United Nations, and you have major human rights organization here in Haiti, which documented how personnel inside this current administration have linked to gangs that, you know, killing people and stop them from protesting. So it's a very complicated situation, and several organizations pointing fingers toward the government with regard to the violence that we are seeing in the street right now.
So, Widlaw, one of the aspects of the dire security and economic situation in Haiti you mentioned earlier, the sharp rise in kidnappings for ransom. Do you know anyone who's been a victim of these gang kidnappings?
If you are living in Port-au-Prince, it's hard to not know someone who was the victim, or someone who knows someone who was the victim of kidnapping in Haiti. In October last year, I was personally the victim of an attempt of kidnapping. I was...
You yourself?
Yes, me myself. I was coming out from work at here at Aibo Post. We are an independent news organization working in Port-au-Prince. And the two people approached me. They had guns, and they asked me to come with them. And we had to negotiate, so they released me. And so it's a very general situation. And one thing that I would notice is, before, we always had kidnappings in Haiti. We always had, you know, this concerning insecurity climate. But what you are observing right now, what is new, is the fact that kidnappers are not going after people who have money. They are not going after people who can pay. If you have clothes and you are in the street, they take you, and they will take anything that you can offer. And at the same time, kidnappers are also going after people who are opposed to the government.
Wow. So these kidnappings sounds like it could happen to anybody. I want to know how people in one of the poorest countries in the world even get together enough money for a ransom.
Well, exactly. And if you were poor, you have to go and ask people around you to give you something. And you are seeing as well people using the internet as a tool to collect money. They raise GoFundMe campaigns so they can pay kidnappers. You have police officers who were kidnapped. Several police officers were the victim of this kidnapping wave that we are seeing in Haiti. So anybody can be the victim of kidnapping, and you don't need to have money actually to be a victim. You have to use any connection that you have to put together whatever the amount is. And if you don't find the money, they will kill you.
The current presidential crisis aside, Haiti just seems in chaos. But as for that crisis with the president, Widlaw, what do you think is going to happen next? How does this crisis end?
The government is trying to change the constitution to give more powers to the president. This change of constitution is not legal. They are moving ahead to have an election. The opposition says that they won't participate in these elections. It's hard to know how this ends. And what is certain is that the couple of months that are coming will be a period of chaos.
We'll keep watching. Widlaw Merancourt is the editor of the Haitian news outlet Aibo Post, speaking with us from the Haitian capital, Port-au-Prince. Thank you very much, Widlaw, for giving us the latest.
Thank you.
In Turkey, there are a few thousand people who trace their ancestry back hundreds of years to the Byzantine Empire, to a group known as the Rum. Many of them speak Greek, practice Orthodox Christianity, and despite forced deportations in the 20th century, they've remained in Turkey. A writer in Istanbul has a new novel out, and her story is set in this small, tight-knit community. She took a walk through one of Istanbul's former Rum neighborhoods with reporter Duri Buscarin.
Before we meet, Nectaria Anastasiadou has one request. No personal questions. About where she was born, about the first time she visited the neighborhoods in the book. She wants her novel, A Recipe for Daphne, to speak for itself, as a window into her community from the outside world. That's why she wrote the book in English.
It's always represented as like, okay, there's only this one little butcher left on the corner, and when he dies, it'll all be over, kind of thing. There is so much liveliness. So I wanted to present our community as I feel it is, not as I feel it's been represented.
We meet for a walk in the streets of Chukurjuma, a tony tree-lined district of cafes and historic apartment buildings on a hill above the sparkling Bosphorus Strait. It's here where, in her novel, we meet Fenis, an elderly gentleman who's been diagnosed with vascular dementia and refuses to accept it.
He refuses his diagnosis. Just as I feel in the Room community, we need to refuse the diagnosis that's been given us. We give it to ourselves, then the outside world gives it back to us, and we keep this vicious cycle going of saying that we're the last, we're done.
In the 19th century, Greek-speaking Rooms lived in communities all over modern-day Turkey. This Istanbul neighborhood was home to some of the community's urban elite. During World War I, hundreds of thousands of Roms, Armenians, and Syriac Christians were killed or forced to leave Turkey. A second wave of deportations happened in the 1960s. Over the years, Chukurjuma fell into disrepair. It's since become regentrified by artists and expats, and is now one of the city's pricier neighborhoods.
I did have Fanis come through here in the novel.
We walk past an antique shop that keeps a display of marble sinks salvaged from old houses out front in the sunshine.
He looks at these old marble kitchen sinks and he wonders how many meals that he had eaten at friends' houses had been prepared by some of these sinks.
Indeed, food is a central theme of this book. It's a frequent topic of conversation, and it's often the way that characters show their love. The title itself, A Recipe for Daphne, refers to a baker's search for a long-lost recipe of an Ottoman pastry. This pastry actually inspired the book. Anastasiadou says an elderly Rum gentleman told her about this recipe that nobody makes anymore.
And he said it was like an eclair and it had different colored creams inside.
Chocolate, vanilla, cardamom, rose, pistachio, saffron, mastic, and the root of an orchid.
He said that each cream represented one of the Balkan people, so that as a whole the pastry represented harmony.
We make our way onto the crowded pedestrian thoroughfare and turn into an alleyway crowded with jewelry sellers and shops. It opens into a courtyard, used as a tea garden in non-COVID times. On the right is a hat shop run by a lady whose room.
I mean, it's one of the very last shops, regardless of what kind of shop it is this hat shop here.
On the left is a gate leading to the Mother Mary Church, a Rum Orthodox church that also appears in the novel. Anastasiadou drops coins in the donation box and lights two candles. She places them directly next to each other so that they share a flame. Entering the gates of this church complex, she says, is a bit like coming home. Here, you'll speak Greek, not Turkish. In the church, where Orthodox Christians stand for prayer, the places are marked with names.
They all still have the names of people who are mostly dead or gone. So you think about those people, you look at the name. But you walk in, you see your friend. And I think that's more important than who's not there. It's the people who are there.
Anastasiadou's book passes as a light escapist novel with a love story. But at its core, it's a meditation on identity and the scars of history. Is it possible to have a future in a place where your community was once targeted and expelled? To Anastasiadou, the answer is a clear-eyed yes. For the world, I'm Derry Buscarin, Istanbul.
Intrigue and inspiration, two words to describe the journey of violinist Yevgeny Kutik, the one he's been on since he was a kid.
I don't have many memories of the place I was born. We left as refugees when I was 4 years old in 1989, searching for a better life.
The Kutuk family left Russia in 1990, when it was still the Soviet Union, and came to the U.S. They were each allowed to bring only two suitcases. Yevgeny's mother, also a violinist, filled one of hers with sheet music. And that's where Yevgeny picks up the story. Hi, Yevgeny. What did that suitcase come to represent for you?
The suitcase kind of became a physical embodiment for me of the journey itself. And as the years have gone by, the scores themselves have just become more and more to represent, you know, family tradition. My home, my old home, my new home is just all contained in all these sheets of paper.
I mean, your family was one of many, many Jewish families from the Soviet Union that were basically allowed to leave. How is that all tied in with music?
Yeah, millions of us went on a very similar journey. You know, everybody had their own path. Ours went through Europe. We stayed in near Rome for about 6 months, essentially just stateless refugees, waiting for an invitation from someone who would host us. We wound up in Western Massachusetts. I was about 5 and a half. I started playing the violin almost immediately. The way I kind of personally learned about my past happened to be through music, because the more I got into playing the violin and expanding my career, the more I started to learn about culture and what I left behind through art.
Mm. And some of that music was in the charts that your mother brought over. Your mom believed this music was part of your family's history. And since then, you've recorded some of this music. I spotted in one of your videos a music chart, and the first page reads, "Pieces by Old Composers." Now, some of these composers will have heard of Prokofiev, Stravinsky. Others not so familiar. Andrei Eshpai, Georgi Sviridov. Who are they, and what role did they play in your family's musical world?
So, yeah, the olden composers. I mean, a lot of them were books that my mom, either herself as a violinist, taught or studied. And they were a compilation of composers who might have been, quote unquote, popular back in her day in the Soviet Union. But, you know, I had never heard of Eshpai. I had never, you know, heard very little about Rubinstein, nothing about Sviridov. I think it's more, and, you know, then there are also things in there by Beethoven and Debussy. And so it's, you know, it's not all just rarities. It's like a glimpse into what violinists were playing at that time in Russia, what was being taught to students on a daily basis in Russia, and what was considered like cool violin music at the time. So, you know, there's quite a lot to unpack in this stuff.
It is beautiful music, and in your hands, I have to say, even more so. In a way, Yevgeny, your life so far culminates tomorrow night in this five-episode recital series based on the album Music from the Suitcase. We're in a pandemic, which must have prompted the virtual concert, but it's really more than a concert, isn't it? Talk about presenting your music and story this way.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, this very much would not have happened had it not been for the pandemic. All my concerts and foreseeable plans just collapsed within a week. And so I spent a lot of time, you know, I called them the quiet months of quarantine. I spent a lot of time figuring out what am I doing, what's next, and reflecting a lot. And, you know, I picked up ever since making the Suitcase album in 2014, I've kind of my mind keeps circling around the same things like family, tradition, memory, home, like what is home? I'm kind of obsessive about that. And so I came up with like five essentially different themes for five different episodes. And, you know, the actual root of anti-Semitism in the USSR, why we had to leave. And then most people don't actually know really what it's like to begin again. And then I reflect upon what I've been doing myself, you know, ever since that time. So I, you know, the pandemic helped me put some stuff into words and music, I guess.
The recital series, Finding Home, Music from the Suitcase in Concert, that begins tomorrow on Yevgeny Kutuk's Facebook page and YouTube channel. Yevgeny Kutuk, it's great meeting you. Thank you very much. We'll be watching.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you.
stay connected with the world and the stories we're chasing. We'll do the work so you don't have to go digging around to see what we're up to. Subscribe to our daily newsletter, Top of the World. You can sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny is behind bars, but the protests in Russia have continued. Navalny supporters have been heavily reliant on social media to get their message out to the public. That includes TikTok, where one young woman with a command of English got a lot of notice recently. But as The World's Daniel Offman reports, her motivations are not quite what most people might think.
Last month, after Navalny was detained, videos with the hashtag #FreeNavalny blew up on Russian TikTok. But one video in particular grabbed a ton of attention.
Фразы, которые могут спасти тебе жизнь, или как притвориться американцем, если тебя задержали на митинге. I'm American. I'm American.
A Russian TikToker with the username Neurolera explained, here are some videos that can save your life, or how to pretend to be American if you get detained at a protest.
Если вас просят паспорт, скажите, я забыл свой паспорт в отеле. I left my passport at the hotel.
And what do you say if police try to push you into a van?
You are violating my human rights.
And if all else fails, there's always this.
Я сейчас позвоню своему юристу. I'm gonna call my lawyer. I'm going to.
That TikTok racked up millions of views. Some saw Neurolera's video as a symbol of Russian youth. It was funny, creative, modern, and politically conscious. But I had to wonder, who is Neurolera?
My name is Valerie Sichova. I'm 22.
Valerie lives in Moscow, and we talked over Skype. At home, she doesn't go by Valerie. Her Russian name is Lera, like in her TikTok username, Neurolera.
This is Russian name, Lera. I have chosen Valerie for my Western conversations because people just cannot pronounce Lera. That's why I do that.
Now, about her TikTok video. Lera tells me that it goes back to the summer of 2019, when a Russian man being detained by police was caught on video. There's a second guy in the video who tells the cops,
I'm American.
Russian police guy is trying to arrest him.
Here's Lera again.
And American guy was like, I'm American. Let me go. What's your problem? And Russian policeman was like, "Кто американцы привел? Who brought an American here? Like, let him go. Let him go. Like, we don't need him." This got super viral.
So the American man in that video walked free. No harm, no foul. Lera and many other Russians thought that was funny. And it's what inspired her TikTok video from last month.
I got misunderstood. Like, I was using the popular topic to show the nuances of American pronunciation.
Lera says people saw the TikTok as a political statement. But what she's always been about, she says, is teaching English. Here's how she explained it in an early TikTok from last year. English, he says, is the main language of this planet, spoken all over the world.
And knowing the main language of your planet opens thousands of doors for you. You can simply move to another country, gain a numerous amount of English-speaking friends, find your purpose of life in traveling and meeting other people. The world will become more understandable for you.
Lera is a private English teacher, and these days all of her instruction is done online. But she doesn't teach English the way she was taught the language back in school. Lera tells me that her teachers weren't really good.
They cannot teach you proper English. They don't really understand what's going on with language, not even talking about that language. It's a live, changing system. And they have those books that were written like thousands of years ago, and you don't use those words anymore.
Lera says one language learning tool she relies heavily on is TV.
By just watching Netflix, I guess, and trying to repeat after characters of those TV series.
It's part of her teaching philosophy called the Neuro method of language learning. And that's where Lera got her TikTok username, Neurolera.
You have to understand patterns of language. The way they sound, like they are specific, and you just have to memorize them. And you don't have to understand what present perfect is or what passive voice is to start speaking.
It's basically a system that emphasizes speech patterns and repetition instead of grammar. Lera uses the method in her classes, and often those lessons turn into TikTok videos. Sometimes, though, it's not strictly about language. Lera uses her platform to discuss culture as well. like the cultural differences she learned about on her two trips to the U.S.
I was eating something like strawberry, and somehow strawberry got on my cheek. And if I hadn't happened to find a mirror, I would have returned home and found it right on my face. No one would tell me about it. I was like, why? It's not offensive. You can tell this. What's wrong with your culture? I didn't understand this.
But there's a lot that Lera says she admires about American culture. She tells me about the summer she spent working as a waitress in Montana.
It was like a computer game. The sky is so blue. The grass is so green. Like, wow. Oh, my God. And people, they smile. Like, literally, you meet someone who goes in the street and he smiles like, what? Are you crazy? You smile like we don't do that in Russia.
Lera says her trips to America were transformative, and they inspired her to become an English teacher. But that doesn't mean she's thinking about relocating to the U.S., or anywhere for that matter.
My home is here in Moscow, and I love traveling. Traveling is a big part of my life. I want to see other things.
When I ask Lera about her views on politics in Russia, her answers are a little surprising. Lots of people, especially in the West, saw her TikTok as a political statement about the protests playing out in Moscow and other cities. But Lera tells me she doesn't spend time worrying about politics, and the response to her video isn't changing that.
I became less interested in politics after. Politics are dirty. It's not something for normal people. I'm not going to take this role because this is something that is going to make my life sad.
Lera says, of course, people want to see change. But she tells me one single person is not able to make that much of a difference.
It's like a sky above you. Can you change the sky? Okay, I don't like this weather. It's rains. Come on. I need some sun. No, it doesn't click. It doesn't work like that. This is the way I see it.
Ironically, it was because of politics that many people around the world discovered Lera on social media. All the same, she says her passion is still about teaching English, and that's something where she feels she can make a difference.
I see people start speaking from zero with me, and I'm so excited about it. Like, I wish I had this when I was a school kid, but now I'm honored to be a person who can provide good English for Russian people.
For the World, I'm Daniel Offman.
Wow, when the student becomes a teacher, really impressive. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you back here tomorrow. From PR.